Welcome to the first open source startup podcast of the year. It's 2023, and we've now been doing the podcast for about 2 years. And my awesome co-host, Tim Chen, and I are very excited to have our first two guests, co-founders of Diagrid, Mark and Yaron. And they're going to tell us all about their platform that comes out of Dapper, which they co-created. And it's really around abstracting away the management of distributed systems, which they are going to give a much more holistic overview of what it does. But welcome to both Yaron and Mark.
Hi, nice to be here.
Yeah, fantastic to be here.
Awesome. So why don't we go back to the beginning? This is probably going back to Dapper and why you both decided to create it and why you decided to create it together.
Yeah, so I think the background of all this is that we were working at Microsoft, where we were both working on an incubations team. And that team was kind of about creating new technologies and things. And we were looking at all the struggles and the pain points and difficulties that developers had, both internal to the Microsoft services, but also all of the enterprise customers we were working with, and seeing how they were struggling to build and productively create distributed applications on some distributed systems platform, whether that's Kubernetes or, you know, just a set of VMs. And so we said, well, how do we make these developers more productive? How is it we can make their lives a lot nicer? And so from that, we spawned the idea of Dapper, which really is about developer productivity, building distributed applications.
Awesome. And I guess for the both of you, why did you decide to work on it together and kind of how did you find each other? Yeah, and maybe I'll get your perspective on this.
Yeah, so I was working on the incubations team for the CTO of Azure, Mark Rusinovich, and we were researching pain points for developers running microservices architectures on Kubernetes and other platforms. And what we've come to realize was that, you know, deployment is being solved, CI/CD is being solved, network infrastructure management is being solved, but developers have this, you know, challenge about how they do event-driven systems, how they do service-to-service communication, infrastructure resiliency, and all that. And so we started a prototype in the team, and we demonstrated to a few people inside of Microsoft. Mark was actually working on the same problem, coming off a different platform called Service Fabric that most of Azure was running on. And he said, yeah, we have this developer platform inside that we want to externalize. And I basically showed him the early prototype that we had. And so we decided to work on this together. And so he came on the incubations team to lead that team. And so we created it together and open source Dapper after about, I think, a year of work in October 2019.
And this seems like maybe an obvious question, but why did you open source it? And was that something that was challenging to do while at Microsoft? Or did they have a pretty open kind of mandate when it comes to open sourcing different projects?
Yeah, I joined Microsoft in 2016, right when there was a big shift between the proprietary kind of tech mindset and moving over and shifting to an open source strategy. So to us, to really make Dapper, you know, a community project and to have it reach the number of developers that it can, we really thought that open source was the best place to create it, to basically bring in different perspectives. It couldn't be a Microsoft thing. It needed to be, you know, something that AWS and Google developers use also. And so open source was a natural choice for that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And we've heard from many founders that one of the main reasons they want to open source something is so that it kind of can survive for an indefinite amount of time and it can just touch a much wider user base. So that it makes a ton of sense. So now Dapper has like over 20,000 stars, a ton of users. Can you kind of walk us through how that happened? So what happened when you released it? Was it immediately adopted quite broadly or did it happen over time? Because it's not that old, if I recall correctly.
No, it's only 3 years old. So it's pretty recent. And I think it's really good to talk about the problem space that it solves a little bit more, just so it's sort of clear on this. Because, you know, what's happened over the last 5 years is developers have been pushed by the business to kind of build distributed applications, microservices architectures. And, you know, they've done that because it gives them the benefits of agility, rolling things out fast, independent code of teams, and all the benefits of that. So, you know, if you look at all the developer reports, they all point to like the number one skills that developers have to have now are microservices architecture, containerization, distributed systems platforms like Kubernetes to build these large scale services. But none of the focus is what the actual application architecture itself. So, you know, as you build these things, what Dapper provides, it provides these APIs that allow you to do event-driven architecture. So you can do pub-sub messaging between your two services. You can do discovery and calling another method on another service. Very, very often we found the problem space where developer teams had to simply load a secret in order to access a resource like a SQL Server database. And they wrote the same code time and time again. So, you know, you look at this and there's all these patterns and best practices, but nothing had been sort of codified in a holistic, standardized way for developers. And so that's exactly what Dapper does. It provides these APIs. And so when we did this, everyone went, ha ha, you know, I no longer just have to write this same old boilerplate code myself. I'm not just pointed at like, oh, here's the best practices in some doc, go and do it all. You actually had an implementation of best practices, irrespective of your platform. It's very neutral, Dapper. It's not tied to any programming language. It's not tied to any platform. It's just a very good set of best practices for building this application. So when we launched it, everyone like, that's exactly what I need. And it got a pretty good traction to begin with, didn't it, Yaron, I think? Yes.
Yeah. I mean, we got code contributions on the first day that we released the project, which was amazing. And we got early contributions from HashiCorp, for example, and others. And we started getting, you know, contributions for AWS components and Google Cloud components. And Dapper quickly became really this GitHub trending project, which brought more and more people to it. And we meet a very diverse set of developers coming to it. You know, for the past 3 years, every day I've been communicating with developers who are not Go developers. They're Java, Python, or JavaScript developers. And they go to Dapper because they want to extend Dapper to make it useful in their organizations, which is amazing because they learn a whole new programming language and they invest their time in the project. So yeah, developer traction has been really, really good. We're over 20,000 GitHub stars, but that's not the metric that we as project maintainers are looking at. What we care about the most is number of contributors. And we have over 2,300 contributors in less than 3 years, actually, which to us is amazing.
No, that's really incredible. It's funny because stars end up getting pointed to as just kind of a metric that someone can normalize across different projects, but seeing kind of the depth of engagement and contributions, it makes a ton of sense. Can you kind of talk us through so you release Dapper, there's a ton of excitement, but I imagine it takes some time for folks to start kind of standardizing because they have to be, I assume, like building a net new application in order to use it. So from interest to then like real world applications, how long did that take?
Well, we actually see greenfield and brownfield use cases for Dapper. Dapper was designed to be incrementally adoptable into existing code bases. And we've seen companies basically like wholesale replace their internal developer platforms with Dapper. So instead of them building like this developer-facing API platform for event-driven architectures, they would incrementally adopt Dapper APIs over time. And so they would also bring it into existing code. I think it's like 60-40 in favor of greenfield versus brownfield, but we're definitely seeing both.
Yeah, that's certainly one of its advantages is that, you know, you can use one of the APIs to solve one of your problem. And going back to like the secrets API, that was a very common one. People just, you know, they needed to store sort of secrets inside some cloud vault somewhere and, you know, access them. And then you could just use that one Dapper API. Or, you know, you just needed to be able to, for example, send a message between two services and use a Dapper pub sub API. So it's very incremental, very usable from whatever language framework of your choice. And I think that's its key, is that it can replace a small part of your existing code and expand from there. And you can choose how much and how and when.
And user adoption, that has been a real highlight of the project. I mean, NASA is using it in outer space right now as we speak. It's running on the International Space Station, helping do PubSub images that are being taken from cameras all over the ISS to detect glove wear for astronauts. So that's pretty awesome. It's also running as the infrastructure backbone for Alibaba's Cloud Functions runtime. Microsoft running it as a service. It's running in a very big high-scale workloads for companies like IBM and Zscaler and others. So yeah, we're really happy with the adoption.
Yeah, and I think that spoke to that, you know, to answer your question a little bit, is that, you know, what we did is we took Dapper and we went to speak to many enterprises and customers who were developer teams. And, you know, it's a very developer-focused problem and said, why don't you try this out and incrementally use it? And that's exactly what they found. They found it very useful for them. So companies like Zeiss, which is a large lens manufacturer, is one of those. And Bosch, which is a well-known German company, you know, they built platforms on top of this.
So that's awesome to hear. That's such amazing names and progress. Maybe I want to touch on a little bit because you talked about the huge success. And, you know, as you know, developers, there's always choices, right? There's so many choices of how you can do something. And I'm always very curious about the Dapper approach. Because Dapper, it looks like there's not just a way to do just one thing, right? Is there a way to do actually multiple things? There's a way to actually, like you mentioned, publish, you know, subscribe to messages. There's things you integrate directly into your application. So you do have to modify your application. versus we've seen approaches where like service meshes just kind of sits outside. It doesn't do as much, probably as Dapr, I assume. There's trade-offs here. And I'm sure people looking at Dapr has to make a choice of, okay, why do I do this versus maybe gobbling a bunch of things together, which most people do before. How did you able to communicate that Dapr is the right approach and help developers sort of navigate that trade-off?
Yeah, excellent question. And I think if I were to encapsulate this into one sentence or phrase, it would be golden pass. So, you know, there's the rise of platform engineering recently, which is about providing your development teams with golden pass that they find it very hard to steer off of. Dapr is a codification of best practices and golden paths for developers. So yes, developers do need to change their code, but what they get in return is basically best practices as code. And they know that their applications are now more secure, more reliable, and more resilient than they have been before using Dapr. So Dapr brings you as a developer a bunch of golden paths, and it lets you choose. You know, you can code your application one way or the other with Dapr, but it's always going to be a best practice and a golden path. And if you basically want to steer off the golden path, Dapr is going to be like, well, hey, you can do that, but just know that, you know, there's a better way of doing that. And this is what you gain from using Dapr.
Yeah. And I also think that the other thing that you gain in this as well is that you gain some platform independence and portability of your code. Like there are many companies that we speak to and they have to have a multi-cloud strategy and they have to deploy across at least two major clouds. Or they have to have technology choices about, you know, what's their queuing technology and things like this. And what Dapr enables them to do is that they can have the same code portable across these platforms because it's a consistent API. And because of this pluggable component model where behind any given API, like for example, PubSub, you can either use Redis or Kafka or RabbitMQ or any number of these 30 plus open source or commercial technologies, they can actually make the code move between these platforms. So that's kind of a huge relief for development teams because all of a sudden they're not tied into having to learn to a particular SDK. They have this portability.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point, Mark, because we've seen Kubernetes become the thing that prevents vendor lock-in at the deployment level, right? Like containers are packaging your code. You basically have Kubernetes and then you become free of vendor lock-in, right? Well, not really, because your code still needs to talk to the underlying services that each cloud has, like SQS on AWS or, you know, Firebase on Google Cloud. So if you have a multi-cloud deployment, that still becomes a problem. Dapr really complements that and frees you of this vendor lock-in from the code perspective, the same way that Kubernetes APIs do for the hosting platforms.
That's awesome to hear. I think that golden path is certainly very important. I guess one thing I wanted to ask, it felt like, as you mentioned it, like the adoption and attraction just happened. But is there any challenges or lessons you have to learn to iterate, you know, from a messaging, maybe when you put it out there, this is how we talked about it and didn't get as much love or maybe certain things, because it felt like you actually didn't start off that Dapr with all these messages, maybe with all these thoughts behind it, I assume. Can you maybe talk about some of the key things you guys have to really overcome to even gain more traction, gain more understanding, or help developers understand? Any key lessons here will be great.
Yeah, so because Dapr was really new in terms of how it approaches these development problems, when it first came out, there was much talk about the way that it operates, you know, as a sidecar, as opposed to the benefits that it gives you. So it took us a while to basically position Dapr as a set of APIs that help developers become more productive. And that's what we talk about today. Dapr is a bunch of APIs that help you become more productive. They make your code reliable, secure, portable. And in the beginning, when we just released it, people saw that it runs as a sidecar. And then they started comparing Dapr to service meshes, which are a completely different thing. And so we had to spend a lot of time educating people about the differences between Dapr and service meshes. Now, when we start off talking about Dapr as productivity level APIs for developers that basically finds them in their with their code, then you know the talk about Dapr versus service meshes or other technologies sort of like, you know, goes in the background.
Yeah, and I think the other thing we found to talk about the iterative process is we really tried to be very, very practical with this and really take it into organizations who are building these applications and watch them build it and be there in their development team. So, I mean, we sat there in development teams for many large enterprises like Bosch and Zeiss and made them use it all and got that incremental feedback. And in fact, they then contributed back into the code base. So that was useful because what happens is that they saw how straightforward it was, for example, to submit one of these new components because they wanted a particular database, for example, to store their state in. And so they could write one of these, submit it, and then the whole community took advantage of that. So I think that close relationship with development teams and understanding their problem space and feeling their pain in what they were building and sitting there with next to them allowed not only the kind of the immediate team building it all, but the community as a whole to actually contribute code back into it all. So it's very, Dapper is very, very much community driven. It's like huge numbers of community contributions because they saw that they could affect that code base and affect their own code.
So let's talk a bit about the Dapper to Diagrid transition. So you released Dapper, you're still at Microsoft, you're seeing a lot of traction. And then at what point were you both like, okay, we're going to create a company around this? And kind of walk us through like the things you were asking each other before you made that leap, or was that kind of the early plan?
No, it was never a plan for us to form a company. Not even 2 years into Dapper did we plan to form a company. I think beginning 2021, a bunch of VCs started coming to us, talking to us about, you know, spinning off a company, but we basically told all of them, no, we don't want to spin out because we had so much on our minds, just, you know, getting Dapper better and creating services around it and then making the community better. But then at some point, Mark and I talked and we realized that we have a vision for distributed systems that we can only do if we spin out of our own company that becomes an independent force in the cloud native space, which is very developer focused and allows developers to really focus on writing their code, not infrastructure. And we formed Diagrid, which I think our main differentiation is we don't focus on the, you know, DevOps infrastructure stuff. We focus on the millions or, you know, dozens of millions of application developers writing business logic and business apps day in, day out. And this is where our focus is at through Dapper. And Diagrid is all about developer focus. Of course, we're investing a lot in Dapper because that's the project that we created and we're commercializing that. But at some point, we will go beyond Dapper and offer even more commercial products.
And I think that what we saw was that we saw this huge opportunity where we could actually change the industry dramatically about how developers write code. Today, developers are very much bound by, you know, a particular language and what it gives to you, or they have to have a particular framework and what it provides to you, or even a particular PaaS platform or serverless platform, what it gives to you. But what we envision is that, you know, developers can take advantage of Dapper wherever they come from by hosting and running those Dapper APIs as a service. And now, you know, you have this ultimate flexibility. And so, you know, there's a lot of talk about API culture, you know, where you have APIs, for example, for purchase orders or, you know, other API or Twilio for communication, but there aren't many APIs for developers to build those solutions themselves. And so we see this whole change of industry now where developers themselves can focus on Dapper APIs in an agnostic way of how they build their code from wherever they come from.
And so maybe talk about more, because I think the Diagrid story, although we've seen some different examples of open sourcing, taking an open source project from a large company and making it a company, I think we haven't seen that out from Microsoft at all before, as if I remember correctly. Is there anything that you learn from other founders about some best practices of how to do this? And, you know, I remember we talked to Joe Heptio before, right? There's this understanding how to take it out, right? How to actually able to execute this and also, you know, work continually with the ecosystem. What are things you guys have to learn about a project like this, which is not truly, it has a different background than maybe some side project, right? Or some company that just using it for their internal use, right? This seems to be a pretty designed approach to create a community project where you have quite a few entities involved. Is there anything you guys have to figure out, like maybe create a governance board or do some kind of conduct? What are things you have to make in place to make this happen?
So in terms of governance, Dapper is a CNCF project. So today there's a governing board for the project that comprises of four companies: Microsoft, Diagrid, Alibaba Cloud, and Intel. And all of these companies are heavily investing in Dapper. Some of them are running Dapper internally also. To be bluntly honest, we didn't really talk to other open source founders when we got started. We basically learned everything, you know, from the beginning. we were very focused on keeping, you know, the Dapper momentum going while we were building out Diagrid. And this is still something that we're looking to do. So I think something that's really important to us is, even though we're really focused on commercialization and building products, it's really important to not take your foot off the gas for the open source project, because, you know, that's where your community is at and you have to keep investing in that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for us, it's community first, build that all out. And I think we have a tremendous vision where we want to take these Dapper APIs and host them so that developers can access the Dapper APIs and build out a service around those. So, you know, we're deeply invested in the community, and we're deeply invested as well in making sure that we build services that make developers productive.
And one of the challenges we've seen with so many open source founders, as their community grows, and also as their community grows and they're starting to monetize, they have so many competing priorities when it comes to just managing such a large community, as well as monetization. And on the community side, so you guys have a very active Discord channel. Like, is that kind of the main place where you're managing your community? And how do you kind of figure out, like, who is managing what on it? You're responding properly. You're figuring out, like, how to feed in remarks from that into your product roadmap, maybe. Like, what kind of framework or strategy or learnings do you have from just community management?
I think something we learned pretty early on was that Discord is great for, you know, ad hoc communications with users of Dapper. But eventually you want to funnel everything that's really important to you into GitHub, because that's where, you know, the code contributions happen. So what we found was, you know, get the conversation started in Discord, but once it becomes too much or too time consuming, or if you identify as a maintainer of the project that it's a real issue, then you basically encourage people to move over to GitHub. So Discord is a great way to start conversations, answer some questions that are short-lived. But if it's anything more than that, we try to make GitHub the central place where people go to find issues and open up bugs and stuff like that.
I think we also found it's very good to be very transparent about what you were doing in terms of, you know, here's our roadmap, here's what we're building, here's what's coming out, allowing people to contribute into that, allowing them to give some feedback into that as well, and help them kind of decide what the priorities are for each one of the releases, and be really clear, like, there are four releases each year of Dapper, they come out each quarter. This is when they come out. It's, you know, this is the time frame it comes out with. And all of a sudden, people felt as if they could see where things were going.
And we also advertise and announce milestones. So inside of these milestones, we basically, you know, lay out what the expected features are for each milestone, so the community can really weigh in. And, you know, someone can go like, hey, well, I actually think that this issue is really important. Then, you know, we'll start a conversation and maybe we'll put it into the milestone, because it really is important to us. So yeah, making the roadmap public was something that we didn't do in the beginning. It took us a few good months, but once we did that, we saw a lot more community participation in how the milestones were being formed. And it also helps us maintainers, you know, to triage the important stuff earlier. I think to the earlier question about things that we learned, something that we did see other companies do with open source is something like an open core model. And it was really important for us to not do that. And basically, you know, offer Dapper as 100% open source project that you consume off of our services. So, you know, we're not going the way of special Dapper binaries that are signed by Diagrid that you pay extra for, that are like Diagrid vetted or anything like that. We also don't offer, you know, commercial support for Dapper running in the cluster. This is also really important to us. Yeah, it was really important for us to basically, you know, offer managed Dapper services, but it's all based on open source so that you don't have any lock-in into our company.
And so I guess I'm curious, well, I'm looking at the offered products that you have. So maybe we can talk about the commercial products, like Conductor, and I see Cloud Runtime API coming soon. We'll actually have to learn more what that is. There isn't any information about it, but it definitely seems to make sense. Do you have a managed control plane, I guess, in some way, helping upgrade, downgrade, and visibility? Yes. Is that an obvious place you know what it starts? Is that what your users been asking for? Or was there a thought process or iteration or journey there too of figuring out what is the right commercial product to build, or even when to do?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think actually the Cloud Runtime APIs, we call them, actually was the thing that really kickstarted Jeroen and I to actually even form Diagrid in the first place, because we saw this huge opportunity. But you still have to answer the question of, is it the right thing? So just to kind of get a little background about what it is. So what we envision is that the Dapper APIs are, you know, completely consumable from wherever you like to run your code. And so our goal is to kind of host those as a service. And now, whether you're a developer that's running on, say, Google Cloud Run or AWS App Runner or any of these other services, you can actually call out and use the hosted Dapper APIs inside our Diagrid cloud, because you want to simply send a publisher message from, say, one container platform into a VM or wherever your compute is. So you're not bound by these particular platforms anymore. So that was our vision of that. And what we've seen as we've gone out and talked about this with lots of customers is that they've sort of endorsed that. And I'll give a kind of good example here. For example, we talked to a couple of financial banks and they say, well, that Dapper thing is all very good, but it takes months for us to consume a new piece of code. It takes 6 months for our security team to vet it. It takes months for us to get into our deployment pipeline. So any new piece of code we consume is as long pipeline, but we're free to open and use these services. And at the same time, there's this movement away up into higher level abstraction services, you know, things that are containerized platforms because of the ease of development inside them all. But the trouble is, not all of those platforms are equal. Some of them have features and some of them don't. So all of a sudden now, developers can choose a compute platform of their choice. Yet through the cloud runtime APIs that we host, they can suddenly do publish and subscribe or secrets management or long-running stateful services or, you know, or calling between these things in the compute of their choice to wherever they want to do it all. And so the freedom for them now will become, you know, extraordinary, where they're not tied to a particular platform, they're not tied to a particular company. And of course, even the Dapper APIs, if they really wanted to, it's all totally open source. You know, they could take it back into their company. So we see this emerging industry category now where developers building these large-scale, secure, reliable, mission-critical applications, you know, can take advantage of our Cloud Run APIs and yet, you know, keep the compute and all their data wherever they need.
But for Conductor, 95% or more of enterprises and companies running Dapper today run it on Kubernetes. So while Dapper can actually run, you know, anywhere, it can't run on serverless container platforms, for example, because you can only run a single container in most, or you can't run Dapper in AWS Lambda or Google Cloud Functions. So most companies run it on Kubernetes. And these companies, the ones that we've been talking to for the past few years, find it challenging operating things on Kubernetes, not because operating Dapper in Kubernetes is hard, but because operating stuff on Kubernetes is hard. And so we've built Conductor, which helps everyone running Dapper and Kubernetes manage Dapper for them. You know, so we do things like taking care of the control plane, making sure it's up and running, downgrades, upgrades, increasing reliability and security for you, which is a major piece of the service. So Conductor is for everyone that's running Dapper and Kubernetes today. And Cloud Runtime APIs opens Dapper for millions of developers more who are not running on Kubernetes, but choosing to run on serverless compute platforms and functions platforms, and even in the browser.
So I want to take a few minutes and talk about the team that you're building. And especially, so now you are thinking about go-to-market. Have you started investing in building at the team outside of, I'm sure the first early folks were all technical, all engineers? And how are you thinking about building out your team now? And maybe what are some of your biggest learnings in team building the last couple of years? Because we get questions all the time from like the founders we work with on how to invest outside of engineering, because most of them know how to build and manage engineering teams. They don't know how to manage go-to-market teams. So how are you thinking about that, especially as we go into a year when that's going to be a bigger focus?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. If I could go back to myself a year ago and talk about it, it's kind of how do you scale the teams in a company? So as you point out, yeah, I think we're very good at building engineering teams. And our focus now very much is building out the other teams around us. And I think the one that's closely behind that is marketing. Like for us, building out, that's where we're building out right now. We're building out our marketing strength and our marketing presence, because you've got to bring the audience to where you are and what your message is. And so, you know, for us, Diagrid, we want to be very much focused on you're a developer-centric company. We're about developers. We want a developer to wake up in the morning and go, what's new on Diagrid today? And they check out our blog or our YouTube video or whatever other content we're creating. And being tied, of course, as well, closely to the Dapper ecosystem around that as well. And eventually, of course, that'll be not just Dapper APIs, but other APIs. So I think that after you've got your engineering team in place, you know, the marketing outside of it is also has to become built out and how you do that. We're also finding that because we got a product to market pretty quickly, you know, we also have to generate a lot of leads. Building out a whole sales team kind of too quickly is kind of the wrong approach. And there is still a lot of founder-led sales. So pretty much Yaron and I do a lot of the founder-led sales, but of course, sourcing and finding all those leads is hugely time consuming. So I think the next thing that you want to get is you want to get lead generation business development reps to help you with all of that and how you bring that in for your revenue stream around those. And then eventually you can learn from that. And of course, that in itself, the sales process is an iterative process. And then once you figured out how that works as a playbook, then you can give a playbook to a sales team and build out the sales team. So for me, it's engineering, and then marketing, then sales, and then after that, it's everything else.
Yeah, and I also want to chime in on interviewing a little bit. And my tip there is make your VCs work for you. And in particular, you know, Mark and I are engineering and product people. We can interview engineering folks and product people. But when you're building a sales organization or marketing organization, you don't necessarily have the right background to actually interview someone like that. So, you know, your VC might have, you know, a CMO who can interview marketing people, or, you know, a sales arm that, or somebody who does sales who can interview the salespeople for you. So know where your strengths are, or even more importantly, where your weaknesses are, and get people who have experience interviewing for these roles to interview your candidates for the areas that you don't feel so comfortable with.
When you speak on marketing, I'm actually curious also about the blog, the content you guys are creating. What are the sort of the thoughts behind it? I definitely like the content you guys write. It's a lot of memes and a lot of points. And there's so much complexity that comes into explaining or talking about that, right? I realize you're talking about use cases, you're talking about the differences, you're talking about the 10X platforms, right? There's so much points. And my impression, looking at your blog, is a lot of people usually take one point and they write a just kind of one content at a time. It seems like you're creating more of like a comprehensive thing. I don't know if that's correct or wrong, but may talk about some of the things you're trying on the content side. Is that driving a lot of discussions or not? Or is this still an active element of how you're approaching, I guess, the content marketing and inbound?
Yeah, I think our content marketing is still only just getting started. I mean, I think that if you came back to us in 6 months' time and asked the same question, it would be very different. But I think one strategy we have to do is we have to create a lot more content that ties at least Dapper back to us in many ways. And it's not really there at the moment. We've got some great content that talks about the industry as a whole, the strategic direction, direction microservices. And that's very important because, you know, you've got to do the big directional scene setting around these things. But it's also the content of just like some good hands-on labs around Dapper, or just some, how do I do some tutorials around these things. Hosting some video sessions as well, where we can have, you know, discussions around how you design services, things like this. So some webcasts around these things and bring people inside that. I think those are all the things that we're starting to plan in the next few months.
So I want to go back over the last 2 years. And if you could talk about a couple of the hardest decisions you've had to make, whether it's been around, I mean, like the last 2 years have been pretty crazy. You've been in the highest market we've all seen, and then now we're going into one of the lowest. So whether it's around like hiring, fundraising, like what are some of the moments where you've really relied on advisors or early investors the most, and just some of the, like the trickier moments that you reflect on now, and you just knew it was a huge growth moment for the company?
I think the Series A funding round was, you know, a major question mark that we had, because we basically got to around May or June 2022, and we've been in contact with VCs that, you know, approached us. Some of them were very interested in preempting the round, and we were basically pushing everyone off. But, you know, as the market started experiencing more and more of the correction, we asked ourselves, well, you know, are we going to see like a major downturn in 2023, which will make funding conditions even more difficult than what they are now? And so the major question we had was, should we basically go for a series of funding now, even though we could have waited, or do we push that back to 2024, or do we try to raise in 2023? And so I think we were lucky in that we talked to some really great VCs, and we got to get to know some really great people, especially, you know, from Norwest, who are the VC we ended up choosing going with, because, you know, we were also fortunate to have the choice about who to go with. And yeah, we basically decided, hey, let's do this now. And we knew that we could put the money to work. We knew we want to scale the company. And so, yeah, that was a major decision, because like I said, the question was, do we do it now, or do we let the Series A funding round go towards, you know, the unknown period that comes later?
Yeah, and it was a lot more challenging. It really was a lot more challenging between October of last year and January of last year in terms of the market change inside. It can dramatically change. And I think for us, that going to that decision of raising the Series A was sort of crucial. And I think it also gave us the relief that, you know, we could actually truly build out the vision for Diagrid, build the cloud runtime APIs, rather than sort of just stick with one product for a while and sort of see how that pans out. And I think giving us that belief that we can go off and build those things together it's been hugely inspiring.
Yeah, I think one thing we had going for us was that we started generating revenue less than 3 months after we had our product out. And so this was a really major breakthrough for us. It also helped in fundraising, of course, but you know, it also helped us in believing more in our ability to execute both on growing conductor sales and building out the second product, which really complements our vision for DiaGrid and for the industry, which is Cloud Runtime APIs.
Yeah, it's really amazing to see because most infra products or projects, you're really just touching maybe SREs, right? Or system admins, but now you're also going for developers. As developer, actually main audience for you, right? So there's a lot of, I guess there's almost like a multi-party sort of marketing you might have to do. We usually ask at the end as well, like what are the biggest learnings? You talk a little bit of the bigger decisions, but like maybe personally for you, you know, as engineer working open source, now, you know, going into starting your own company, what was the biggest learnings? You know, I'm curious each one of you that you have to like learn or anything surprises you even better. Like, oh, I didn't know I needed to learn this or I didn't know that was that hard.
Yeah, I think there was a ton of things that we learned. And I think we didn't know much about running and building a company, you know, when we first kind of kicked off and left Microsoft. And I think here we are a year later and we're kind of transformationally different. I think the biggest learnings really is like, there's the whole, how do you attract people to your company? How do you convince the first people to join your company, being those founders, the founding engineers, the founding team together? I think having a good, strong network of people and having a strong conviction about what you're going to build is one thing. I also think that, you know, there's a lot of advice you should lean on just about all of the other business practices, the biz ops that you have to do. It turns out, you know, building the product is one thing, but then the whole payroll system and hiring system and all those things, putting that in place also takes a lot of energy and time around those things. And leaning on people to help you kind of make choices around that helps a lot. And I think that gets back to the whole general scaling. You know, how is it that you think about scaling a company all the time? For me, it's always about, okay, how do we scale a company and how do we build things that we constantly evolve? Because, you know, the company will be very different in a year's time from now, but you have to evolve it as it goes and you can't be too fixed in your processes, but at the same time, you don't want to be throwing everything away. So that balance between the things of process you can put in now, scaling things and getting up as you grow the company is a pretty challenging thing. And I think that's where you really should lean on the advice of other people who've done it before you.
For me as a CDO, I and an open source core contributor of Dapper and Cato before that, for me, the major learning was to learn how to let go of things and really delegate stuff to other people. So for example, when we just got started, I wrote a basic prototype of Conductor. And, you know, I assumed we'll be creating service off of that. Then we brought people with really diverse perspective from Rancho Labs and Red Hat and Microsoft and other companies. And at some point I was like, well, you know, I need to focus on Dapper open source too. And I basically let them run things to the ground and just create, you know, their vision of the architecture. And I think that's really important, you know, letting your employees take ownership and envision things and really lead the services that you want to build without you as a CDO or founder being too prescriptive from the beginning. I think that worked pretty well. It took me a while to get that mindset, but once they did, things really started taking off. And then the other learning for me was not to neglect your open source project. As an open source founder, especially in these, you know, market conditions, you'll be hard pressed not to try and drive monetization revenue pretty early on. But you can't neglect your open source project. It has to gain the momentum. That's specifically for open source founders. But yeah, I think it's really important.
And I also think between the two of us as well, we were very keen to create an open culture and writing down our cultural values at the beginning and using that as a guiding stone helps a lot. And I would very much encourage someone to kind of write down, you know, the type of culture that you want to have in a company. And it will change. It's not always the same. But, you know, what is it you want to achieve from the first year of the culture in terms of how do you want people to react with each other, collaboration, trust, that sort of stuff. And setting those founding values and culture together just helps people bring them together. And at the same time, you know that you want diversity, you want open opinions, you want people to be outspoken yet move on.
Well, I think that's a fantastic point to end on. And this is such a good episode to start the year with. We really enjoyed having you both on. Thank you so much for doing the podcast with us.
Thank you.